Hey there, welcome to another episode of Dangerous But Good. Today I have a friend, a colleague, a brother, all-round great guy. Looking forward to this conversation. Vikela Rankin. Vic has worked around the world in leadership, in the C-suite, in many, many companies, blue chip companies, digital transformation, sales strategy, you name it. A generalist, but also, I call you a freedom fighter. Vic. I mean, you've been, you stand against the things that are bad in society in a powerful way. So welcome.
Thank you very much.
Good to be chatting with you, man. I know we postponed last week's recording because you were invited to a mass ceremony of ex-ANC dignitaries who had, well, not ex, but past ANC dignitaries, one of which was your dad. Your father was one of the secretary generals of the ANC, passed away in Zambia many years back, was buried there, and the ANC actually exhumed the remains and had a ceremony here in the Union Mills. How did that go?
Yeah. Wow. What an amazing, amazing time. What amazing event. And interestingly enough, it wasn't just ANC. This was the actually amazing sort of first glimpse into the government of national unity.
Fantastic. So it was multiple parties.
Yeah. What was really, really interesting to see was that the Deputy Minister of Defense, Bantu Holomisa, was there.
Okay.
And then, of course, we had the Minister of Arts and Culture, Gayton McKenzie.
So the character himself.
And, you know, all kudos to him.
Yeah.
I know this has been a labor of love for many, many, many years. Mm-hmm. But what I think he did was just pull it to the finishing line. Mm-hmm. And he did it very quickly. Yeah. My sister came along and said to him, you know, there's a story about, and it's 47 exhumed bodies of people who passed away in Lusaka and in Zimbabwe, and right. They're going to go around to others. But my sister went up to him and said, this story about this, you know, exhumations taking place and the return, when's that going to happen? And this was the beginning of September.
Right.
And he actually said, end of September.
Oh, wow.
And she was.
So he'd already set the ball in motion.
Yeah. We were like, we've heard this before, yeah. Right?
He's a breath of fresh air, isn't he?
Yeah. No, he's fantastic. And he pulled it off. It was fantastic. Absolutely a spectacular event. Really done very professionally. Great speakers. Tribute that I think to be paid to all those who paid a hefty price this freedom you and I live under, the blanket of freedom that we live under.
Which some take for granted now, not realizing the blood that was spilt and the pain that was endured.
The blood that was spilt and the countries that were involved to help us get here.
Right.
Because when we look at, you know, countries like Tanzania, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Angola, Zambia, and many others, they did not really enjoy their independence because they spent a considerable amount of time, money, and effort in ensuring that the rest of Africa was independent. So, you know, they played a significant role in accommodating a lot of us who were traipsing around in countries outside South Africa.
Right. There's definitely a new air of hope in the air, isn't there, with a government of national unity. Are you feeling that?
I'm certainly feeling that what we need to be doing is reframing our thinking, and that's unlearning what we've learned. And I'm certainly beginning to feel that, you know, several months in, that the government is beginning to, look, it'll have its rocky bits, but I'm beginning to feel the winds of change coming in.
In a positive way.
In a very positive way. Yeah. In a very positive way. And, you know, and one of the things, you know, Gayton McKenzie, the minister, said to the president when he was there, in his face, he said that, you know, we've really been hitting him quite hard. But one thing that we need to do is pay kudos to his ability to have brought this massive, diverse group of people together.
Well, I think that is his strength, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we struggle with his inability to lead and make decisions and be decisive. But I think he's a conciliator, isn't he? He's a unifier. And it's been surprising is to see it seems to be quite joyful at the new situation. He seems to have really be happy that there is now some unity of the nation.
you know, without being a pundit for the ANC, that is the fabric of the ANC. The ANC is an organization that was built on the principles of a certain value, but also built on the principles of ensuring that diversity is part of the core of how we get to those value systems that we're looking for. So I think he's in his element,
right,
because I think the DNA of the ANC is exactly this.
Which it had horribly strayed away from, hadn't it?
It had. And I think they would be the first to admit that. Right. And I think now, I think this, you know, sometimes with great challenges comes great opportunity. And I think this government of national unity is a massive opportunity for them to be able to gather up what was their, you know, their history and what they did before and what we hoped for and what we desired and what we expected and start running with that.
In other words, to get back on track. Get back on the track. We started in 94, but kind of straight off a decade or so later.
Exactly.
Which is quite exciting. So, Vic, I mean, you're doing amazing work in I think one of the biggest challenges we face in this nation is youth unemployment.
Yep.
And you're doing amazing work with your organization, Value Ed, in the digital transformation, empowering, equipping, training, educating youth to play a role in the economy. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I mean, as I was driving here, I was just thinking about, because we had an amazing session last night, I was just thinking about this construct of Value-Aid and not only where is it going, but where it came from. But mm-hmm. I'm one of those youth members. I you know, I was least likely to succeed at school. Mm-hmm. I actually, Craig, this is really funny. I actually only discovered recently that I was in a special ed class.
Okay.
Do you know that? It's weird because when I was at the time living in Zimbabwe, I ended up in a B stream. And in a B stream, the equivalent would have been if you wrote matric in 12 years. In a B stream, you'd write matric in 13 years.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So you were given an extra year. So all the ingredients that talk to being a little slower. And for me, that was, you know, a really interesting time. But also the ability to have lived in diverse countries. And I failed my last year of school, A-levels. I had to repeat, but I had to repeat in the UK. And I came across people who opened my mind mm-hmm. and made me realize that there was a difference between who I am and what I do or what I am in terms of, you know, special ed. And that's what forced me to push forward to get into university, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But going through that journey, I discovered that, you know, there are just so many things that I only found out much later in life. So the whole idea of Value Ed was to try and create as much access as possible to as many young people as possible to be able to meet specialists and industry experts so that they can broaden their minds from a scholastic point of view. This is not a academia where you come in and write assessments and learn. This is kind of the feeling you get when you've gone to a good church sermon and you feel inspired.
Real.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And we want it to be ingrained in you, into your DNA, as opposed mm-hmm. to just languish in your mind for a short period and then retained and then written in an exam.
A lot of life skills involved there. A lot of
Critical life skills. Absolutely. So we are very diverse. We've got several pillars. One is about finding your passion, purpose, mm-hmm. and position. Yeah. You know the story about
passion,
you know,
purpose and
position.
Position.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got an interesting story about that with my conversations with God. But the other one is, you know, your career, your choice, mm-hmm. which is discovering which career and choice you're going to go in. Once you find your passion, purpose and position,
things become a lot easier.
You when you're now building towards something very specific, you can do that. And then the other one is turning ideas into money, which is about growing a business.
Right.
The other pillar is about becoming more. Mm-hmm. If you want more in life, you've got to become more.
So it's about taking responsibility.
It's about taking responsibility.
Being the best you can possibly be.
Exactly. And then the last one is about social issues. So all the challenges that your great work does, particularly around men and men of value, but we do stuff with women of valor, etc. So it's a digital online platform that you come on, you listen to experts like yourself who've come on many occasions, and hopefully all these blends of different pillars enable you to find something about who you are and become a positive contributor to society at large.
In many ways, would you say it's a refathering of people who grew up unfathered, unparented? The kind of skills you should learn in a home which has a present mother and a present father, teaching, modeling, sharing in a village where there's a group of men and women in the village who are mentoring you. These are the kind of skills that a lot of kids are not growing up with in South Africa because of the absence of that.
Big time. You know, I was just thinking about it the other day that we've got this generational move where we had the silent generation, then we had the, you know, baby boomers, and then the Gen X that I'm part of. We were the first group of children who sort of started having a situation where parents started going to work.
Right.
Both parents, right? Although our generation started nursery school around about 4 or 5 kind of scenario.
So you still had those first 3-4 years with?
With your family.
Yeah.
Then if you go into the millennials, now this is where divorce rates are very high. Single parenting is very high. But the biggest thing is that, you know, both parents were going to work.
Right.
And children started going to nurse from 4 months after maternity.
In some ways, orphans of heart.
Orphans of heart, because as I say, it's huge single parenting, absenteeism in terms of that integrated family kind of structure.
Yes.
And then obviously now when you then look at Gen Zs, then, you know, that's a completely different kettle of fish, because now you're talking about, you know the stats, 60% of our children born in this country don't have a father on the birth certificate. But now we've got these gadgets, right? So children are brought up on gadgets.
Right.
So they don't engage, get access to, speak, learn, get the stories that our grandmothers used to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really very challenged. So this platform hopefully begins to re-inculcate into them some of those values that industry experts, as well as, as you say, fathering both, men and women, it's essential to give them the skills they need, the critical skills to survive.
This is a bigger crisis, I think, than what we realize, isn't it? Unfathered, unparented youth growing up and then entering the youth market, well, the job market, and there's just no opportunity. I mean, the unemployment statistics for youth are just through the roof. And you can't help thinking, unless we deal with it, this is a ticking time bomb that could really, really sabotage the future of our nation.
So there was a recent document that came up. I'm not sure if I think it's Fortune magazine that said that there is a prevalent high rate of dismissals of Gen Zs from the workplace.
Right.
So Gen Zs are getting fired within 18 months. So when you say it's a crisis, it's a major crisis,
right?
Because you are having a group and a generation of young people who don't really know how to adapt, assimilate, acclimatize, and adjust to different environments. And that is going to create in the future some major, major challenges if young people are not given the tools to be able to start understanding how it is that, because a workplace has now got 4 or 5 generations,
right?
In one hit.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is a major, major challenge.
You know, I think back to the book written by Stephen Covey. You probably taught the book yourself, Seven Habits of Highly Effective. And one of the things he talks about there is the law of the farm, which is you cannot escape the law of the farm. You know, unless you till the soil, plant the seed, weed around it, water it, wait, have patience, and dig some more, and then you're not going to get the end result. And I think growing up in a world where everything's instant, you know, instant music, instant food, you know, you're not taught the principle that someone worked very hard to get that food onto your plate. Someone worked very hard to create the cell phone that you can look at. And unless we have that law of the farm inculcated into our youth, it's going to be a disaster, isn't it? Because nothing comes out of nothing.
So that analogy you've just given is the kind of teachings that we would like to consistently give to young people, because it paints a very vivid picture that they can digest and go, that's almost the old traditional grandparent stories about how life actually works. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the challenges is, let's take your analogy a little further. once you've planted the seed, you have to wait. Mm-hmm. And the waiting is the difficulty. But the also the analysis of what are you waiting for? Because the seed has to go through a series of processes where it now starts developing its roots. And that's right. The first thing that happens, right? Yeah. So you are assumptive that nothing is happening. Meanwhile, the seed is acclimatizing to its mm-hmm. environment. It's letting its roots out. So 3 weeks later, before the fourth week when germination mm-hmm. takes place, you remove the seed because you think, it's not working. You run out of patience. You go and plant it somewhere else, right? You wait another 2 weeks and you remove it from there and then you go and plant it somewhere else. Yeah. Now the seed, instead of taking 4 weeks to germinate, it's going to take 6 weeks to germinate mm-hmm. because it takes longer, but you're irritated by week five.
Yeah. And you feel entitled. Why is this thing not happening?
Why is it not happening and I expect it to happen mm-hmm. now? And I think time and history together with all the technology that's and things that are creating some of the challenges is unfortunately teaching young people that element of life, that things need to happen, you know, overnight. I mean, there's a great quote that says the greatest maths you can learn is to calculate the current cost of your future decisions or the current cost of your future decisions. Exactly. So the what you do today has a massive impact in terms of your next 3, 5, 10, 20 years time. And more so now, because the speed at which things are changing is significantly faster than in the 1900s, right? So in the 1900s, you could trot along mm-hmm. for 10, 15, 20 years and you wouldn't see much difference. Mm-hmm. Today, you see a difference literally every year or every 6 months, right? ChatGPT came out, in 2022? It's on version 4 now. Most people don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
So you're spot on. It's important to teach young people this construct of the relationship between time, mm-hmm. patience, and resilience.
Right, and we take so much for granted, don't we? I mean, we drove here on a road. Now someone built that road. Someone maintains that road. That takes blood, sweat, and tears, labor, and material which needs to be mined. You know, we drive in a vehicle which needs to be manufactured. You know, factory workers that make that thing. I mean, this vast infrastructure that we just enjoy. We switch on a tap, water comes out of it. You know, we flush the toilet. You know, the effluence goes mysteriously underground and disappears. I mean, these are luxuries and these are things that have taken decades and years and much, much, much sweat to put in place. So how do we build for tomorrow, Vic? I mean, you're involved in digital transformation. And I mean, for me, we're living in quite a it's exciting, but it's scary. You know, Elon Musk was saying the other day that he thinks that the demand for robots will exceed the demand for vehicles in the future. That every household will have their own personal one or two robots doing everything that a human can do. You know, I mean, things are changing, which means that work is going to change completely. A lot of work will be automated, and the need for human beings to get involved will be less and less. I mean, it's a very frightening world. ChatGPT is scary because, you know, I'm an author. You write a book and you know, you're now competing with a computer that can write a million times faster than you. And at the moment you can tell, but, you know, down the line, will you be able to tell? You know, there was my son's in the movie industry and there was a big hoo-ha recently where companies are buying up the rights to use your image and your voice. They can program into a computer and then they don't need Vic anymore. They don't need the actor because they've got your image and they can make you do and say whatever you want, you know. And that's, you know, actors were getting scared because we're not needed. You know, you can replace me with a digital image of me. I mean, how do we deal with this?
Yeah, look, I'll touch on two parts that you said there. I think they're very powerful. I think the one part is taking things for granted. We really need to consistently reflect on the fact that currently in the life that we live in 2024, it's fundamentally different to the 1900s. Yeah. So on every matrix, we're living better, right? Yeah. So
better than kings did in those days.
Better than kings did in those days. So the realization that despite the difficulties and the challenges that we have, as you said, all the different elements of infrastructure and lifestyle that we have really give us a sense of difference, including medicine and all sorts of things. I mean, I think if the pandemic had happened in the 1900s, I'm not sure how much would have left of the world. So I think that's one element. And one of the ways in order to recognize that is gratitude. I think everybody has a locus of control of things that they can actually be grateful for. Yeah. And that's an intentional decision to say, I'm going to spend time just thinking about what are the things that I should be grateful for rather than the, you know, what are the things I'm going to complain about, mm-hmm. right? I think that's essential. And so actually a mindset shift I've had to make, because I did ask the question to my family the other day as to what percentage of the time do you take thinking about negative things or positive things?
Right.
And I actually realized probably a greater part of my life, Craig, is thinking about negative things, mm-hmm. right? My mind is always consistently thinking about things that I need to worry about or anxious about or complain about, et cetera. So that gratitude element is very important. When you micro segment that gratitude, you then get to the point where you're saying what you're saying,
right.
which is you give thanks to people who are putting things together, arranging things, and giving you the platform to be able to access life in a different way. Digital transformation for me is the most exciting thing that's happening because for, you know, there are two reasons. The one reason is for there is a danger to it, but there's a gap we're going to fill very quickly. When we grew up, Craig, the measure of who you were was defined by money, the class position that you were in, mm-hmm. race, and intelligence. Now, if you had those four, you were creaming it. Mm-hmm. You were on the run. If you had three of the four, you were doing really well. If you had two of the four,
things are getting tougher.
You'd still succeed, but things would be getting tougher. AI takes that completely away. We are no longer, I don't have to sit there and think, oh, Craig's so brilliant because he knows the capital of Romania. You know, Craig's so brilliant because, geez, he can calculate Pythagoras' theorem. I can do that now. My daughter can get up tomorrow morning and ask Siri or any piece of technology mm-hmm. what it is and what it requires. Back then, you needed two things. One, a good friend who understood the answers to the mm-hmm. questions, or a good set of encyclopedias.
Right.
Today, we don't need that. So it's creating a level playing field where we're not measuring each other on money, intelligence, et cetera. If we know how to use technology, we're all on the same level playing field. The other thing that it's also producing is the capability for us to do this. Back in the day, you'd need to be a celebrity to be able to do a podcast like this. You'd need to find a studio, et cetera. It'll cost you a lot of money. Now I can point a phone camera to mm-hmm. my face and I can become, you know, overnight.
You can send it out to the world.
I can be a sensation. So we're creating a level playing field where if you find your passion, purpose, and position, mm-hmm. and you maximize the technology that's around you, you can become much quicker than you were able to before. What's the downside? The downside is that it's going to create the biggest gap greater mm-hmm. than class and mm-hmm. finances ever did. If people are left behind in this, they're just never going to be able to catch up. Your inability to understand what technology is, what it can do. If you don't know how to Zoom, if you don't know how to download Teams, how are you going to get an interview?
Or you don't have the means. Or
you don't have the means. Yeah. How are you going to get an interview if it's on Teams? Right. And the scary thing, Craig, is the means and access is one component. But what's even more scary is you have the means and access, but you still can't.
You don't have the knowledge.
The curiosity, the interest, and more importantly, the initiative to go and discover, because this data is out there. If you want to find out, how can I start a podcast? I mean, I'm sure if you YouTubed it.
Yeah, you get 1,000 different lessons from people around the world.
That curiosity, that sense of initiative is missing. And that's the gap we need to fill. And the other gap that we need to fill is that once you find your seed, your identity, and who you are, as a human, literally nothing on this planet can overtake that, right? Now, if you thought that you were destined to put bottle tops on bottle caps on a bottle, then I'm not sure you really understand what your purpose and passion is. Let technology take that over and run with that. Even in the context of your book, yes, it'll write a book, but it'll never write a book like Craig writes a book.
Right. The heart, the soul, the passion, the insight, the understanding.
It can replicate it, but it can't be it. And that's where you need to find that, all those that you've mentioned, the heart, the soul. Mm-hmm. If you don't know your heart, your soul, mm-hmm. and who you are, then the ability to really authentically produce that will be very difficult. And it will be replaced by something else artificial that can do it.
Mechanical. It's skin deep. It's superficial.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, that's a brilliant analysis you've given us there, both of the upside and the downside. I love the fact that it's a level playing field, you know, that a youngster living in a village in rural KZN, if he has access to and knowledge of how to use a computer and has access to Wi-Fi, I mean, he can take on the world without having to have anything else other than the technology. But the downside is how many youngsters are growing up in South Africa that don't have the means to access a computer or the training. And the other downside, which I'd love you to speak to, is having access to everything in the world. I mean, I was just talking to my wife the other day, you know, when we grew up, you're the same, you know, to get a bunch of music in your vehicle was a hell of a mission, man. You know, an old TDK cassette tape, you had to record it, you know, and take it. And then you couldn't just jump from one song to the next. You had to push fast forward and it would zzz, and then you randomly, I mean, now with this, you've got access to the entire world's library of songs. It's phenomenal. But you've also got access to pornography and junk, a huge amount of junk. And so the value system of human beings comes into the thing. You've got access to, I can do a Harvard course on this, or I could watch porn and everything in between. And so my choices about what I'm going to do with that are absolutely crucial, aren't they? And that's a value system. That's teaching youngsters that you can be a rock star, you know, figuratively, but you've got to make the right choices. You've got to feed yourself the right diet. You've got to use tech in the right way to teach yourself, grow yourself. You know, choose education over entertainment every day, and especially not smutty entertainment. How do we do that to the next generation?
Oh, you're touching on something that's that I'm very passionate about. And one component to add on the difficulties of the technology is the stress, depression, anxiety, and all the different things that, unfortunately, social media or some of these technologies bring on individuals.
Because we're too engrossed in our screens and not in the real world.
We're too engrossed in our screens. We don't understand the difference between what's reality and what's being depicted. So Craig can go and start, you know, putting up his profiles of all his beautiful life and cars and trips and holidays and et cetera. And we assume that that's Craig's life with absolutely no issues. And that's the life that I want to have. Yeah. Or I can, you know, what do they call it now when you do something to your face?
Beauty shop. And
so you can, there's so many things that you can do that don't authentically depict who you are.
Right.
So, and this is if I can chat on this for a minute, it's something that was a revelation to me pretty recently and a godly revelation to me, because it was a question that I was asking about myself with regards to my sense of validity. So where do I get my validation from?
Your legitimacy as a man.
My legitimacy as a man and really getting down to the nuts and bolts as to how much of it is ingrained in me and it comes from me and how much of it is a worldly thing. And when I really started diagnosing this, I began to realize that actually it is a worldly thing. And the danger with worldly validations, which you are not aware of, is that you seek them in places and in times and in things that you don't even consciously or intentionally realize that you're seeking them. So people who scroll, right? What happens is that the system takes over, dopamine kicks in, mm-hmm. and you just spend your life scrolling, right? So you lose all intentionality and yourself in it. And I'll tell you, Craig, where this came about. It was a thought to myself about this construct of validation, and I had an amazing conversation with God. Mm-hmm. And God asked me a very simple question. He said, do I like myself?
Do you, Vikela, like yourself?
And I thought it was a very strange question. And I actually said, well, of course I do. I do like myself. And he said, do you love yourself? Because there's a distinction between mm-hmm. like and love. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I think I love myself. And he said, okay, well, if we need to really understand your sense of validation and where it comes from, you need to answer this question and think about it before you answer. Do you know yourself? So at that point, I said, yeah, of course I know myself. So he says, well, okay, give me three strengths about you. So I said, well, my three strengths are I'm a communicator, I'm a collaborator, and I'm a speaker. So he said, great. He says, those are not your strengths. So I said, well, I don't understand. He says, well, let's diagnose those strengths. Communicator, who do you communicate to? People. Collaborator, who do you collaborate with? People. Speaking, who do you speak to? People. So if those people are not there, or if they tell you any differently, or you get a sense from them that they are not necessarily appreciating what you think is your strength, how do you feel? So I said, well, I'm not sure I'm going to feel very good. He says, well, then your validation is external.
It comes from other people.
What is your strength? So I thought, well, I'm not sure. He says, okay, let me give you an example. He says, what is the function of an apple seed? So I said, it's to produce apples. And then he said, well, that's great. And do you think the apple tree, when it produces apples, cares or not whether or not you eat the apple? No. Says it'll still produce apples because that's what it's designed for. Superman is designed to fly. Do you think his flying is dependent on whether or not he's giving somebody a lift, or he just decides if he's going to Cape Town, he's going to fly? And I slowly start to get it. And then he actually says, I want you to think about what is the superpower that I gave you for you. I gave you two eyes to see. Yes, they're helpful when you have to look for something for somebody, but they're yours for you to see. I gave you two hands to hold things. Yes, they're useful if you want to pick up something on behalf of somebody else, but they're yours. I gave you two legs that you can walk. What have I given you that is your strength for you, that is not dependent on somebody else or whether somebody else sees it, uses it, but I gave it for you, just for you? Wow. Now then I had to think. He says, because the moment you don't understand that, then you don't know yourself. And let me tell you, if you don't know yourself, you're not going to like yourself. But if you don't like yourself, how can you love yourself? And the things that you do when you like yourself are about personal excellence once you know yourself. Mm-hmm. And personal excellence will always force you to think about the impact of the thing that you're doing to you. So if you want to keep away from all the vices of the world, you can only keep away from it if you know who you are as a person, and that validation of you, who you are, comes from you. Mm-hmm. So I sat down and I thought about it, and I thought, okay, so what are my strengths? And it turned out that one of my strengths was the ability to manifest. This thing about gratitude. Mm-hmm. I looked around me and I thought, there's nothing that I have thought about that I haven't gotten. Mm-hmm. He says, well, that's your power. Think what you want to think and manifest it. Mm-hmm. The second thing was that I have ability to attract people. So for some reason, people come to me. And one of the interesting things is, as I was thinking about this, I started feeling a bit odd, because it's now you're talking about yourself to yourself about yourself, right? And that's not what
you feel a bit arrogant and pride and self-absorbed.
Marianne Williamson said, what our greatest fear is not that we're inadequate, but we are more powerful beyond measure.
Who are you not to be fabulous?
With all those strengths that you have, that you can use for you, by you, so that when you use them for you, you then have gratitude. One of the greatest, most powerful things God said was, people tell me what they're grateful for what they have. I'd like you to tell me about what you're grateful for who you are.
Who God made you to be.
Which seed I planted in you. Right. And once you discover that seed and you really work that seed, you will like yourself. So that was powerful, because the transition from liking yourself to loving yourself.
But to loving, I think it goes deeper than that, because you love who you think you want to be, not who you actually are. You love the image. You know, you look at a lot of Hollywood stars. You know, I look at a lady like Cher, a beautifully talented woman, but couldn't grow old. She had to have lots and lots and lots and lots of surgery, because I think the love that she felt, the affirmation she felt, was all about the image, the externalities, her ability to sing and be beautiful. There wasn't what you're talking about now, a sense of, this is who I am, and I deeply know that, love that, embrace it, and I'm able to bring that to the world authentically. I don't need cosmetic surgery. I don't need externalities. I don't need affirmation, because I have it from within. I mean, that's really what you're saying. So a lot of people like themselves, but they like the image of who they are, as opposed to the reality of who they are.
They're still externally validating themselves. So love, well, what is love? Mm. Well, Corinthians 13 tells us what's love. Mm. Love is patience. Love is trust. And this is to you. Are you patient with yourself?
Because you can't love others if you don't love yourself, can you?
If you're not patient with you, you're not going to be patient with others. If you're not trusting of yourself, if you're consistently envious, if you see others and become envious. So when you love yourself, you stop being envious. You stop being boastful.
Because you're happy with who you are.
You stop being boastful. Yeah. You know, you trust yourself. You have confidence in yourself. You start beginning to reassess who you are from the construct of this belief system that you now have, that God's given me something so powerful that I can maximize, yes, for me, but the spillover effect. If Craig can be the best version of who Craig can be, the spillover effect is that we all benefit from that. You know, your light shines.
Others benefit.
So, yeah. So I think to come back to your point is that how we get young people to become better versions of themselves is to give and inculcate this kind of understanding and knowledge. That will then enable them to be able to look at their environments and then start deciding what works for them. And if it's not something that is inculcated in who they are in terms of how they know themselves and like themselves, they'll keep away from it. They'll say, that's not for me. They'll say, this doesn't improve me. This doesn't add to me. This doesn't make me love who I am. And that's really the hope that
we try to build. Interesting, because that starts with good parenting, doesn't it? I mean, a good parent sees his or her child, sees who they really are, helps them identify that. They don't write the script for them. They help them uncover the script that's already written on their heart. And a good parent then validates that, says, you know, I see who you are. I might be a soccer player. You're a piano player. Well, you know, and who you are is good. I see it and I validate it. And then I nurture that, you know, and then I also discipline that. I say to you, you know, these are the boundaries in which we need to operate. And then I equip and empower you to do life. And a child who hasn't grown up with that, I certainly didn't. Many of us didn't, you know. Some of us had fathers who were there but not there, present physically but not doing the work that a father needs to do to bring out in his child. So the fatherless crisis is massive. I mean, single moms are heroes in this nation. They're heroes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
A single mom, the burden on a single mom is just phenomenal because she often has to work long, long hours. And in working long hours, then she has to come home and be both the father and the mother, which is an impossibility. And that village, too, which used to raise a child, has also fallen apart. So we have a real crisis of parenting and fatherhood. No fault generally, no fault of the moms, but absent fathers. I want to come back to that because I know you have a passion for men as well. You know, the value in men. What do you call your men of value?
Men of value, yeah.
But the other thing, Vic, to add on to what you're saying is that I heard recently a profound statement that says, pleasure is a substitute for joy. If we know ourselves, love ourselves, believe in ourselves, have a sense of legitimacy, there's a joy that comes with that.
Yep.
If we don't have that, we seek pleasure to replace the joy we don't have.
Yep.
We seek drink, we seek alcohol, we seek sex, we seek all these things which are poor, poor substitutes for a deep sense of wholeness and holiness. This is who I am and this is what I bring to the world. Because then you don't need those things. You enjoy them. You can enjoy them appropriately. Food is a pleasure. You know how many people look to food as a pleasure swing to anesthetize the pain that they're feeling. You know, all of these different things. And I think the more we move people to what you were saying there, knowing, loving, being themselves authentically, the less problem we're going to have with addiction and all these different things. Because addiction is an anesthetic that covers up the pain that you feel through not knowing and loving yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I'm not no psychologist or certainly no doctor, but as what I understand is that when you're trying to raise your dopamine levels, your serotonin levels, you know, raise the chemicals that make you feel good, you will seek, if you don't understand that you can actually do that internally, those goose pimples that you get when when you just have a moment of a thought of an exciting idea and something's just landed on you, you go, oh, wow, that feeling that mm-hmm. creates that sense of excitement, that you can internally create that. And that the power of the forces that made you can do that. And if you don't know that and if you don't understand that, then what you'll typically do is you will go in and source it. Yeah. One of the things that I'm finding significantly powerful to kind of find the level of joy or peace that comes with really truly understanding yourself is meditation. Mm-hmm. It's a simple thing.
Getting in touch with yourself, isn't it?
But, and yeah, exactly. So the challenges of men very particularly is this sense of validation. Mm-hmm. I think there's been a lot of things that have been externally very destructive. Yeah. And I think one of the biggest things that we need to change as a society and as human beings is this generalizing mm-hmm. stuff. You know, men are. I mean, it's the most, mm-hmm. you know, and the challenge that I find very interesting is that we do to us what was done to, you know, we do to others what was done to us.
Wounded so men become men who wound.
With race issues, you know, we talked about, you know, white men are, mm-hmm. you know, with gender issues, we talk about men are. And it's not true. You can't generalize every single man to be a particular way, and you certainly can't generalize every particular race to be a particular
it's
way.
It's a ludicrous proposition.
It is. So that has created our own personal spiral. Mm-hmm. Because when we see something, whether it's another man, whether we see another race group or whatever the case may be.
We put them in a box.
We put them in a box and we internalize that box as well. Mm-hmm. And then that creates the kind of, you know, anxiety or uncertainty or whatever it is that it produces. So we need to start identifying ourselves as individuals mm-hmm. and we need to call out individuals, right? So not every man is a bad man, right? And the construct, and I love this, dangerous but good, the construct that you can use a certain feature of who you are to produce good is essential. I mean, let me tell you something. Superman can be very dangerous,
yeah.
but he still takes the cat out of the tree, right? And that's the analogy that we use, that we are given the ability to protect, mm-hmm. and that protection comes when we need to defend, and we defend the most vulnerable right. in our societies. And we're not all the same, Craig. Yeah. I mean, you're 5 times bigger than me in strength and size, right? And if Michael Jordan was to walk in here, we'd all dwarf, right? So even within men, we're not the same. So this idea that all men are such and such mm-hmm. is absolutely not true. And we need to, you know, we need to destroy that narrative mm-hmm. completely. We don't, you know, eliminate it. And I think when we start doing that, we create a better platform for men to start being able to assess themselves mm-hmm. and find themselves, because remember, this narrative about men starts at young boys.
Yeah.
So you're now having to unlearn what you've been telling a young child since the beginning. Society, media has played a very dangerous role in doing that. So once we can do that, I think we'll create a better society for men to take up their positions in society, and also then be able to see other the you know, women as who they are and for what they are, you know. As we were saying earlier, there's a difference between being equal and being important.
Absolutely.
We as human beings are all important, but even as men, we're not equal to each other. No. There's a fundamental difference. So as an important means you have the right to, mm-hmm. right, as important.
You but are equal equally, means equally valuable, but not equal in terms of strength, wealth, intelligence, all of those.
Absolutely. And importance is value, and we have red blood, and I'm assuming as human beings we all do.
aliens in the room.
Yeah, and you walk this planet, you should have an unalienable right to the importance that you have as a human being to have from birth to death the ability to fulfill your purpose, your passion, and your position. That should never be denied to you. But in that, we all have roles to play that are pretty significant. You know, my daughter, I said to her, because obviously this, you know, equal story is being passed around. I said, we're all equal. She said, yes, Dad, we're all equal. We're all. And I said to her, well, where did I come from? And she says, your mummy. And I said, okay. And where did you come from? And she said, mummy. And I said, okay. So daddy didn't produce anybody, right? No, men didn't produce anybody, right? Can a man produce children? No. All right, then we're not all equal. Mm-hmm. because there's something that you can do that I fundamentally cannot do.
Right.
And then I said to her, well, when mummy is, you know, was having you and she was 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, would it have been a good idea for mummy to run up and down the stairs when I say, fetch me this or get me that? Or if there was a man downstairs who was breaking into the house, what would you have expected? And would you have expected me, mum, to carry all the heavy bags and et cetera? No, Dad. Who would you have expected to help mum? You. Exactly. So when you were born and mum was holding you in your hands, would you have expected me to make mum do a whole lot of things that were there? Who would have, you know, no, you, Dad. What would I have needed to do to make sure that mum was comfortable? Make sure you protect her. That she's, you know, you're a little baby, you're 9 months, you're an infant. So that, you know, she began slowly to say, yeah, so the we have a role to play whilst you are being, you know, whilst you're growing, and mummies have a role to play. But we're all important. It's very important that we recognize that we're all important.
Equally important but different.
Equally important but different. So I think that narrative has to be produced so that young boys can say, oh, I have a role in life. Because right now I don't think they feel they have a role in life.
They're not being demonized, aren't they?
They are. And you know, what was it? Hashtag men are trash or something. Yeah. That's a media thing that was allowed through social media to just find its way through all avenues.
And it was born out of anger, wasn't it? Born out of a legitimate anger, legitimate pain and hurt, but it was unbelievably destructive. I do a lot of work with boys at schools, and I ask them often, you know, high school boys, are you proud to be a man? And most of them, well, yeah. I said, would you put that on social media? Oh, no. Why not? We'd get canceled, sir. You know, and you think, wow, what a tragedy. If I'd be canceled for being proud of who I am. It's insane. It's just an insane proposition.
Yep.
We need to teach our boys that true masculinity is a beautiful gift to humanity and teach them how to use their masculinity for the good. Unless we do that, boys are going to grow up thinking that they're bad, inherently bad. And that's going to cause all kinds of troubles in society. They're either going to become very passive or they're going to become aggressive and play out in all sorts of ways, and destructive to self and others. So absolutely crucial. You know, talking about Gayton McKenzie, well, he said something the other day, which was fascinating. It was a speech. He said, you know, there's an expiry date on things. Did you hear that speech?
No, I didn't.
He said, there's an expiry date on blaming your parents for not raising you properly. There's an expiry date on blaming your ex-wife for screwing you over for all your assets in the divorce. You know, there's an expiry date for that. There's an expiry date for blaming the past for what you're doing now. And I thought that's such a powerful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
If we walk through the rest of our lives blaming something that happened in the past or even in the present, we become victims. We're completely disempowered, you know. And I think part of the narrative of growing into the future is abandoning the mindset of blame and saying, you know what, it's up to me now, man. What happened, I can't change. But I can change me and my attitude and my perception. And I think you teach a lot that of that at Valuate, don't you?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the kind of leaders that we believe in Valuate that we need to, and I'm going to use the word sort of deliberately because I want it to be contextualized as what we're trying to breed new leaders. Yeah. We need a new type of leader in the future that sees things very differently. And this construct of blaming one another and seeing one another for our races and for our genders. We're not getting to that point, and particularly as men as well, where we see each other for human beings. I mean, I'll give you a classical example that's just occurred in my mind. One of the greatest challenges that we don't recognize as men is that women in the workplace absolutely and utterly require certain levels of support in certain areas. I mean, they are the mothers who raise children. And I was having this conversation the other day about the remote working. There are mothers who have to raise children, and particularly in this day and age where they are single mothers, right? And yet we still apply the same kind of principles to them as we do to men. And that's something that I don't know how many policies and organizations have been looked at to say, hey, we're all getting equal leave. We're all getting equal this, that, and the other. So other than, you know, the maternity leave, which also is pretty negligible in more senses than one. So there's a need for us as men to really look at across the table and say, this is a human being. They play a critical role in the existence of our lives in this planet. What do we do to make things a little bit better and easier for them and for all of us? And I think that kind of lead is the future is the future leader that we need. And when we do that, then we stop looking at past injustices and history. They're relevant to give us a guide to go forward. But to your point, we can't use them for 30 years and we can't use them, you know, against, you know, whoever it is in the past that might have done what they've done. We need to figure out how we grow from that. And life is a journey. It's going to have difficulties. You're going to meet people along the way who are going to make things a little bit tough. But it is incumbent of us to consistently reflect to make sure we know who we are and stand strong in that. We like who we are and therefore are able to produce the difference between excellence and perfection. Mm-hmm. You know, perfection is an external validation. Right. Excellence is an internal validation. Mm-hmm. So when Craig gets up at 5 a.m, when he's working out, nobody sees that. Mm-hmm. Right. But if you're going around, you know, wearing your watch in a particular way or your suit in a particular way, or you want the glass to sit in a particular way, everybody has to see that. So it's that personal excellence. And then also this thing of loving yourself and trusting yourself. So if we can get to that point, then and create human beings who are thinking like that, then I do believe from the gender side, we'll be able to work completely differently with each other. From the race side, we'll be able to work complete tradition, cultures, whatever it is. We see each other as human beings. And the part of forgiveness has to play a role in all that. So if you decide to continue carrying things from 30 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, you got to under-contextualize that the human being then was very different. Was it right? No, it was absolutely not right. But contextualize it. I mean, one of the things that we all have to do sometimes, even with our parents, is to go, look, they were who they were. Mm. They come from their, you know, the silent generation. Was the generation that came after the First World War, right? So their parents were just nothing but caught up in war, right? The baby boomers were parents who came out of the, were people came out of, whose parents came out of the Second World War. So they just knew nothing but that, right? We have parents who've come out of the trauma of apartheid. So they, there's an understanding that we need to move forward and improve ourselves, but there's also an understanding that it's, I get it. I get how you saw it that way. I get how you thought it was that way. But I'll still look across the table and say that I believe in you, they're still good. And all we need to do is find the path that actually produces that, right. Not only for you to forgive yourself, but for us to be able to find the temperament to forgive you. If we do all that, then this blame thing just
falls away.
Away. It's there for a fleeting moment.
Empathy helps a lot too. You know, if I'm part of a particular group of individuals whose ancestors oppressed another group, I need to acknowledge that and be aware of it and be empathetic towards the effect that that had. Can't fully understand it because I didn't live it, but empathize. And that's the kind of interaction we need, isn't it? You know, seeing each other human first, but having had very different experiences. So I'm a human, you're a human, we are of equal value. I know the experiences you had. I do a lot of work with corporates and I get men to tell their stories. And I tell you, Vic, I say, look, guys, this is a sacred space. I don't want to know what school you went to. I want to know your challenges, your struggles, your tragedies, your hopes. And as men begin to tell their stories, man, I tell you what, empathy just increases, understanding, tears flow, because suddenly I'm seeing you as a human being, but I see, wow, you went through stuff I can't even imagine. And I have a newfound respect for you. So I think that's the kind of leadership we need, isn't it? It's empathetic, listening, hearing, understanding, validating, leader of equal value and importance, but certainly different.
Craig, I've known you a long time, and what I can say is that you're able to elicit that from people is because they can trust you. Mm. And the only way they can trust you is if you trust yourself. You know, that journey from knowing yourself to liking yourself to loving yourself. Love and the ingredients that make up love, one of them is trust, right? And if you don't trust yourself, others can't trust you. And that ability to be able to elicit that out of individuals is so important, because I think we use the word empathy, but you can quickly pick up that non-authentic empathy, because it doesn't last very long. And it doesn't last very long because it's not founded on on love. And love is the thing that you need to have and be before you can actually produce it to others. It's hard to be empathetic to someone if you're not empathetic to yourself, right? And I think the more we can appreciate this growth within ourselves – that is so necessary, then we're then able to pass that over to others. And the role in the work that you play means that you give people, you shine a light that gives people the sense to be able to express themselves in places and times that they were never able to. They didn't have a dad that they could hold on to who validated every movement that they made, irrespective of the fact that at the same time they were trying to discipline mm-hmm. them. There was no nurturing ground that was planted or was created so that you could plant the right seed so that they could blossom. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, that empathy and the role you play with that and the ability for you to exude that is something that you're passing on to others, and hopefully they'll be able to pass it on, and the winds of change will create a new and more dynamic man and a new and more dynamic world where we all work in harmony with each other.
Vic, we could talk for hours, brother.
We could.
It's beautiful stuff. I mean, really, really, we need to refather our nation, don't we? We need to bring love, equal importance, nurture, discipline, vision, education. I mean, the kind of things you're doing, the kind of work you're doing, the kind of thing I'm involved in, we both have the privilege to be involved with. And I think fighting for what's right and good and positive and unifying is what we all need to do. Any final words? I know you've probably got a million final words, but well, any final words?
No, well, the final words are your words that you just said. Fighting for what is right and good. I think that is the mantle that we should take up. And as men, we need to take up that mantle. And I think society will be better for it. We all know all the tragic things that are happening, not just in our country, but around the world. And they are really a sign of, for me, where people have given up fighting for what is right and good. And I think ending off on that tone and those words are probably the most powerful. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, man. Just to end off, you know, some beautiful messages have come out of this. I think the primary one, we are all equally important. We're all of equal value, but we're not all the same. And that's a beautiful thing, because Vic brings to the table things I can't. I bring what he can't. And together we bring it all. And it's absolutely beautiful. And as South Africans and citizens of the world, we need to acknowledge each other as equally valuable human beings, but different, and celebrate that difference. To build together. So thank you for listening. Thank you, Vic.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure, man.
Thank you.